This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Ultimate HA7 Joint Formula from Purity Products. Ultimate HA7 features the joint-boosting benefits of hyaluronic acid. HA works like a shock absorber, helping to cushion and soothe your joints. Plus, this HA also hydrates your skin. It's powerful support for your joints, cartilage, skin, and connective tissues. So call 800-983-1154 and get a full-size bottle of HA7 for only $9. And you also get free shipping. Call now to claim your $9 trial bottle of HA7 with free shipping. 1-800-983-1154. These move fast, so call now. 1-800-983-1154. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. This is a podcast that I'm very much looking forward to doing. Not that I don't look forward to doing all my podcasts, but in particular today we have a very, very important guest. He's Dr. Richard Feynman, who is known as a real iconoclast in his chosen field of nutrition because he is one of the foremost advocates for low-carb dieting. And that's bucking the trend in his field. He's a professor of cell biology, biochemistry at the State University of New York, SUNY Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn. And he has worked in many areas related to protein chemistry and physiology and biology, biochemistry. He teaches at the medical school. He's been a pioneer in incorporating nutrition into the biochemistry curriculum. I wish he'd been my professor when I was in medical school way back when. He is principal author of a 26-author compendium entitled Dietary Carbohydrate Restriction as the First Approach in Diabetes Management, Critical Review and Evidence Base. And on a more popular level, we want to share this with you because you as astute listeners may very well want to turn to this resource because it's a wonderful, wonderful book. The World Turned Upside Down, The Second Low Carbohydrate Revolution, which is about to come out in its second edition. Is that correct, Richard?
It's actually already out. It's called Nutrition in Crisis, and you can get it at Amazon or from the publisher Chelsea Green. So it's been out for a few days now.
And so the subtitle there is How the Science of Carbohydrate Restriction Arising from a Ragtag Collection of Popular Diets Defeated the Powerful Low-Fat Army and Became the Default Approach to Health. And clearly there's really been a turning point in our understanding about how low-carb diets can be employed to further health. But the battle isn't over. As we'll soon see, because there's still a lot of controversy about this. But you take aim in your book at what you claim is the deplorable state of nutrition science. Can you explain why you came to that conclusion? I mean, you are a biochemist, an expert in this field. You're an educator. And yet you see that this area is replete with problems.
There are many problems. There are technical problems. The real problem is that a large part of it is not good science. And basically, science is really not cyclotrons. It's basic honesty. It's basic trying to ask the appropriate question and deal with the answer, even if it's not what you wanted to hear. And that's what we don't see. There's also technical problems in the sense that a good deal of what's going on in nutrition is running with a technique known as epidemiology, where you look at population data and you try to make an association between a particular stimulus and an outcome, say a disease. And that has real standards. Nothing in science is a human activity, so things aren't really absolute. But there are standards in epidemiology, and those are violated consistently.
So can you give us an example of a study that you feel is particularly egregious in its misrepresentation of its conclusions? I mean, I can think of many, you know, among them the recent study showing that, once again, eggs are bad for you. And then, of course, study by Lancet, which suggested that meat is bad for you. And then there have been studies that, another Lancet study that showed that the low-carb diet actually is dangerous. You know, I can think of many, so they just come fast and furious.
Yeah, well, I think, well, they've been around for a long time. It's been a consistent pattern. The reason that they've suddenly intensified is that 2018 was the year of low-carb. And what we saw were three or four really strong studies which pretty much nailed the case that a low-carbohydrate diet or keto diet, some kind of significant carbohydrate restriction, is the first approach to treating diabetes. Type 2 diabetes, well, type 1 diabetes, you know, is patients with type 1 diabetes are not making insulin or not making a sufficient amount, and they do require external insulin or other medication, but a low-carbohydrate diet has a dramatically good effect on this, so that they need less and they get better results.
And you may be familiar with Dr. Richard Bernstein. Dr. Bernstein and I were classmates at Einstein, so I'm very familiar with that approach, the low-carb approach for type 1 diabetes. He himself has type 1 diabetes. He's going strong as he moves along into his, I believe, and it was well into his 70s. So clearly, yes, there's a place for it in type 1 diabetes, but especially in type 2 diabetes, right?
Well, type 2 diabetes patients are making insulin, but they have what's usually described as insulin resistance. It's not having the effect that it's supposed to have. The insulin is a kind of global hormone, and so we think of it mostly in terms of regulating blood glucose. So, for example, insulin in a normal person, when carbohydrate comes in the diet, insulin will turn off the production of glucose by the liver so that glucose doesn't become too high. It's important to regulate blood glucose at a consistent level. Obviously, too little is not good because several cells depend on glucose, particularly brain cells. And too much is not good because glucose is chemically reactive. So a person with type 2 diabetes will have high blood glucose because they're continuing to produce glucose from the liver, even in the face of more glucose coming in. But insulin is also a global hormone, so they'll also have lipid effects. And for many people, especially if there's no end organ damage, a low carbohydrate diet can be a cure. They're essentially, they don't, the blood glucose is regulated, the lipid effects go away, and most important, they come off medication. I don't know any disease where coming off medication isn't a sign that you're better.
And even, you know, I attended recently in New York a couple of years ago. They had an exhibit on the origins of insulin. And before the advent of insulin, people, of course, succumbed to their diabetes. But one of the strategies that actually sustained life, it wasn't perfect. It didn't, you know, cure people of their diabetes. But it did allow them to have some additional longevity, was a very low-carbohydrate diet. And I actually saw diaries scribbled by kids in the 19-teens and 1920s, which very scrupulously noted their proteins, their fats, their carbohydrates. That was the dictum prior to the introduction of a life-saving medication. That was the only way people stayed alive, with a very low-carb diet.
Right. Well, there were also very low calories. Starvation diet was also part one of the possible treatments, although that may have been exactly because you're also reducing carbohydrate. And one of the major figures before insulin was Elliot Jostlin, after whom Diabetes Institute is named. And Jostlin has published, I think, a book in probably 10 editions. You can actually buy them on Amazon if you are interested in history of medicine. Possibly all books are part of history now, but you can see his recommendations for low carbohydrate diets. And he says, you know, you have to eat meat and vegetables, and that's about it.
And that was like 1920 or something like that, you know, very, right. Almost 100 years ago. And yet there's sort of a lost art to the dietary management of diabetes. What happened? Why did we go astray?
What happened is that when insulin was discovered, it was a miracle. I mean, you had even, part of it is that, we didn't know until, I think the 30s, that the difference between type 1 and type 2. And so patients with type 1 really depended on insulin and could die without it. And, Jostlin had a reputation beyond his intellectual understanding as a very caring doctor, and he suddenly saw insulin as a miracle. He could now save people's lives. The mistake he made was that he I think we all, it's a mistake that persists to this day that diabetes is a hormone deficiency disease. Mm-hmm. And while superficially that's true, it's more a system disease. And what that means is that you can't get real control of it by exogenous insulin. So what Jostlin thought was that, well, now we have control because the patient can now eat, quote, their normal diet, which of course included carbohydrates, as long as they, quote, cover it with insulin. Mm-hmm. And that...
It led to the dietary exchanges, the carb exchanges, you know, these are the portions that you can have. And then actually people sometimes chase their insulin. It's like they're taking a set amount of insulin. They have to eat a certain amount of carbohydrates to keep up with their insulin.
It's tragic, really. I mean, what's seriously tragic about it is that you can't get the kind of control that you want on that a normal person has by exogenous insulin, unless you need very little, and you need much less on a low carbohydrate diet. Mm-hmm. And so it's still a adjunct to a person with type 1 diabetes, of course, still needs medication. And but a low carb diet is now a very valuable adjunct. And this was brought out by work from David Ludwig's lab, but Bettina Lennertz did a study through the internet, through people out there who actually have diabetes, and gave
they surveyed them. Yeah,
it's medical. Yeah, and backed it up with medical records. And it was a, I think, a landmark, partly because of what people thought was wrong with it. And what they said is, well, you're just getting people's opinion off the internet. But that's good. You have to back it up. You have to make sure that it's accurate. You have to make sure that it's consistent. But it's a access to the patient that we didn't have.
And it's real life experience. It's not under some artificial lab conditions. It's not with an experimental animal. It's with people in real life who are reporting actual implementation of a diet that they're not doing under some condition where, you know, they're in a metabolic ward.
You said it. And that's, so people criticized it for that, but they didn't see that this is, if we follow this, we're going to learn a lot. And then there were three other studies from Sarah Hallberg and Jeff Bullock and Laura Saslow, just essentially nailing down that this is the best way to go for diabetes. And the review that you mentioned, we emphasize that this is the first approach. You know, not everybody's going to want to do it. Mm-hmm. There are people who will tell you they'd rather take the medicine than try to control what they eat. And that's their choice if it's offered to them. Our objection to traditional medicine is it's not offered. And it's not offered in a consistent way. And it's not, if it's offered, it's not offered in a positive way, despite the obvious outcomes, which are so beneficial.
And so when medication is offered, they've actually determined that getting blood sugar ultra low with more medication may put the patient in jeopardy. So they become more lenient about what your hemoglobin A1C should be if you have diabetes, precisely because it's not how low you go, it's how you get there. If you get there via a stringent diet and exercise, get down to a hemoglobin A1C of 5.6, that's a hell of a lot better than using medications to artificially tamp down your glucose.
Right. I think it's very important to say, though, there is one a serious warning about a low-carbohydrate diet, which is that if you have diabetes and you're on medication, mm-hmm. you should not go on a low-carbohydrate diet without talking to the health provider, because they have to reduce the medication
right.
In advance. And, I mean, to me, that's one of the signs that it's so effective, because it's doing the same thing as the medication. But you get better control because it's an endogenous control system. You have evolution working on your side. I think one of the important ideas is that insulin is a kind of master hormone, and that's why diabetes is kind of a iconic metabolic disease. So one of the reasons that we ask whether a low-carbohydrate diet will be good for cancer is because of the association between diabetes and cancer, and also with insulin itself. So I always describe insulin, well, I describe metabolism as like American football. You know, there's at least 22 different things going on at once. And the key to the play is usually taken as the quarterback. So that's why TV follows the quarterback first. Not every play is like that, but you get very far. And insulin is the quarterback in metabolism. And it's a good place to start. It's not going to guarantee you every single event, but that's the idea.
Is there any prospect that the powers that be, the American Diabetes Association, the conventional RD groups, will begin to recognize this and employ a low-carb diet? Or is there still such innate resistance to the idea that fat could be beneficial?
There's both. I can't think of the name of the site, but it's from the AMA, and it has an evaluation of the keto diet becoming more popular.
Right.
And it describes an experiment being funded by the Arnold Foundation that David Ludwig is carrying out. And then it has some of the old guard giving slightly positive points of view, now saying it's safe, whereas they had a different opinion a year or two ago. It's what I call slouching towards low carb. Mm-hmm. They're trying to accept it without losing face. At the same time, there's a vehement, desperate backlash. So the same message that came in my mailbox with this study of Ludwig's experiment also referred to the eggs and cholesterol. That paper is would be laughably bad if it weren't that it's so desperate, so poorly done, and one of the authors is on the Dietary Guidelines Committee that I think just met this morning, and so we got things going in both directions.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a look at that egg study, because it all kind of goes back to what's called the lipid heart disease hypothesis, which is that cholesterol and saturated fat are what gunk up the arteries. And intuitively, I mean, that idea has been really sold to the American public. It kind of makes sense. You know, you eat a greasy burger, and that grease literally goes into your arteries and lines them with gunk, yellowish gunk. It's an appealing hypothesis. What's wrong with that?
It's your body is not at 37 degrees. Your body is at 37 degrees. Your body is at a higher temperature. It's making your arteries smooth. I'm just kidding. What's wrong with it is it's it's not true. But the real point is that we've done experiments, and the Framingham study. Well, what I ask medical students. One of the questions that I don't actually put this on an exam, but I give it in a lecture. I say the large scale experiment that showed the value of the diet heart hypothesis was the Framingham study. This is a very large study carried out originally in the 60s, or the Oslo heart study, and then I list five others. And of course, the answer is none of the above. You know, we keep doing these studies. They show no effect of saturated fat, no effect of total fat, no effect of cholesterol. And medical establishment has given itself the privilege of ignoring those. And they'll probably do another one. I always quote my daughter at age 9 on this issue. We were talking about superheroes. And I told her that when I was a kid, I used to listen to Superman, and the voiceover would say, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound.
This is in the days of radio, it sounds like.
Right. And she said, you leap tall buildings, you only get a single bound.
That's pretty good.
That's right. They keep doing these things. I don't know what they expect to happen. Mm-hmm. I think the problem is that one of the things that I said, that we're not accepting the failures of these studies. The other thing is that the when I teach students how to write a paper or how to give a seminar, ask them, what is it that you want to do? What is the main goal in presenting this? And before they get really annoyed, I tell them that the answer is teach. You want to transmit information. And I tell them, because they're students, I say, when you give a seminar, we're willing to accept the fact that you know stuff. You're not trying to prove anything anymore. You got to teach us. And that's what these diet heart studies are not doing. They're snowing people. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I'm trying to do is, and in the book, I try to give some guide to how to read the studies that yourself. And the advantage.
Critically evaluate them.
Exactly. Yeah. And the advantage that we have that we didn't have, 20 years ago is you have access to these studies through the internet, and you can be your own expert. The trouble is that you have to, it's science, but it's not rocket science. Mm-hmm. But even simple science, you have to understand what's going on. And the key question in epidemiology, which is where most of the trouble comes from, is the comparison of two different studies. You know, for example, a low-fat study and a normal study. You compare those and ask, what is the relation between heart disease and how much fat you eat? Mm-hmm. And what you do is not that complicated. They can make it complicated, but basically we all know what probability is. It's the number of ways of winning divided by all the ways. It's what you do in Las Vegas. And you may not make a perfect deduction about what the probability is, but it's not a bizarre concept. And related to that, the odds. So probability is the number of ways of winning divided by the total number of ways of playing. The odds are the number of ways of winning divided by the number of ways of losing. The kinds of studies that go on in epidemiology, the incidence of those diseases is relatively rare, so it doesn't matter. The odds and the probability are very close. Probability in the medical epidemiology is called risk. And there's one final variation. I know this sounds technical, but it has a simple bottom line, and that is that if you measure the risk over time, it's called hazard. Mm-hmm. If you open the paper, the hazard ratio, the relative risk, the odds ratio, those are all the same thing. They're not exactly the same, but for all purposes, when you're talking about disease states that are studied in epidemiology, you can consider them the same. So you're in a position now to ask about relative risk. What's the risk in case one versus the risk in case two? The standard in epidemiology, the classic case, is the study of cigarette smoke and lung cancer. And this was done by Bradford Hill and his associate Richard Dahl. So what they did is it was a snail mail survey. They actually mailed physicians and asked them, got information about their pattern, and then they measured, they got medical records and the number of people who had died in their study. And as Dahl described it, they got a whole bunch of, they had a few hundred people who had, of these physicians who had died, and they had 36 who had died of lung cancer. So then they wanted to see, of the people who had died of lung cancer, how many were big cigarette smokers. And the answer was all of them.
Okay. Well, that's a pretty resounding conclusion there.
That statistics is easy to deal with. Mm-hmm. Well, they then, of course, carried out a much more extensive study. So what they found is that the odds ratio, in other words, the chance of dying as a cigarette smoker versus the chance of dying of lung cancer, the chance of dying of lung cancer as a cigarette smoker compared to that of a non-smoker was 20 to 1. If you were a heavy smoker, it was 30 to 1. And what Bradford Hill said is that the if you now switched over to a different disease, if you looked at heart disease, there was only about 2 to 1 for cigarette smokers. We hardly ever see 2 to 1 in any of these epidemiologic studies.
Yeah, I think it was like eggs, high egg consumption increased your risk by a certain, you know, small, low digit.
1.17.
Okay, there you go. And that's supposed to be a public health message that we should all stop eating eggs? I mean, I just don't see how that translates.
I don't see how it got published.
Yeah.
Well, one of the people, Linda Van Horn, is an author who's on the Dietary Guidelines Committee. So in case you're having any optimism about the outcome there.
Yeah. Right, exactly. They wield a lot of influence. I'd like to pause now because we divide these podcasts into two parts, but I have a lot of questions for you about what you alluded to earlier, which is low-carb or keto diets for cancer. That's another research interest of yours. We're talking to Dr. Richard Feynman. He's a professor of cell biology at the State University of New York, SUNY Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn, and author of, give us the new title of the book, because the book has been rebranded, right? It used to be called The World Turned Upside Down, The Second Low-Carbohydrate Revolution. It is now being re-released as?
Nutrition in Crisis, and it has this subtitle, Flawed Studies, and other pejoratives that I can't remember.
Okay. Nutrition crisis is plenty. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.